talking.
It's broken. It's in there, so it's fine. The following is an unrehearsed interview with James M. Finch Jr. For the Kentucky Oral History Commission by John Clee. The interview is being conducted at the offices of the Bank of Maysville. Mr. Finch, just to begin, could you tell me a little bit about your background, your family, and how, you know, where you were raised and so forth?
Well, I was born in Mays Lick, what at that time was known as the asparagus bed of the world, and it still has a sign out there that says asparagus bed. Put up by Sanford Roth years ago. Mm-hmm. Sanford Roth's the man, I think, that started the bank in the Bank of Mays Lick.
Uh-huh.
Now located in the middle of town, a nice bank too. Mm-hmm. Nice customers, nice directors, yeah. Nice officers. My family, my grandparents came from New Jersey and Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all English stock, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
And migrated to Maysville and on out to Mays Lick. Bought a farm or two at Mays Lick and settled there. The Mitchells did. The Finches settled in Maysville. And the Mitchells and Finches got together, and they were in the grain business here.
Mm-hmm.
Then later developed the old Mitchell Finch Bank, which was located on the corner of Court and 2nd Street, later Finch's Drugstore.
Mm-hmm.
And I was born in Mays Lick. I'd hate to tell you how many years ago, but I went to school there.
Mm-hmm.
And to kind of date myself, I started the first year in school. I was on a while. The school bus or the school wagon was drawn by two horses.
Sorry.
And that's been 2 or 3 years ago.
Yes, sir. So you
and ready? Later, well, I rode a pony to school. And then later, well, I went down to Columbia Military Academy to school, graduated there after 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and went on to Philadelphia, to Pierce School in Philadelphia. And after about a year and a half of that, I was offered a real good job on the stock exchange, and I took it. And I hate to admit I was there when the stock market broke in 1929. I saw 5 suicides in 5 days.
Gee.
I saw one lady soon after she jumped off the 14th floor of a building across the street and cut herself half in two.
Now, you were a young man at that time.
Yes, sir.
Had gone in with a firm in New York, or?
No, I worked for them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right.
Assistant floor broker.
Uh-huh.
And I learned then in Philadelphia that if you're going to do something, there's no use starting with a janitor, you go up the top. And I'd been offered this real good job, and I was more or less a kid.
Uh-huh.
Didn't know who to talk to. Drexel and Company had the largest bank up there at the time. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in and asked the secretary if I could see Mr. Drexel. And she was nice enough to go tell him as a kid out front wanted to talk to him. She took me in to see him, and no one could have been nicer than that president and chairman of the board of the biggest bank in Philadelphia, and a gentleman that I'm sure was a multi-millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
He told me what to do and what he thought was right, and after his interview, I've gone to the top instead of going to the bottom many times in many places. He taught me the right way.
Uh-huh. So when that happened in 1929, did you come back to your
after
Kentucky?
The market broke, and I happened to have $1,600 left in cash, and I put that in my pocket and came back to Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. What was waiting for you here? What
and was glad to get here. I worked for the Home Warehouse that winter.
Mm-hmm.
And went to Florida for my health.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was in March, or about February or March. And went to Florida for my health, and my dad called me up down there and said, you can buy a lot next door to the Home Warehouse, and your aunt and I will help you build a warehouse if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
But you better come on home and see about it. I did. Charlie Clark was my neighbor, and almost my brother, or I felt like he was almost my brother. His dad put up some money. We bought the lot and built a Standard warehouse. And that's where Standard Tobacco Company got started in 1932.
Now, when you first entered the warehouse business, you worked that winter of 29 and into 30, and of course Delta Standard Warehouse mm-hmm. in 32. That was before there was a support price and so forth.
Oh,
what
yeah.
was that? What was the warehouse business like?
1932, you could buy 100 pounds of tobacco for 50 cents. Today, last year, 1 pound of tobacco would bring $1.50 or a little better.
Right.
That showed you how economies change.
Mm-hmm. Now, at that time, how were farmers bringing in the tobacco? They had multiple grades? And
they'd bring it in, and a lot of them bring it in wagons.
Mm-hmm.
And there were many trucks, too, but
yeah,
there were also
vehicles,
lots
right.
of wagons. And there were many, many grades of tobacco. And at the back is the University of Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And the Carolinas finally persuaded them to not mix tobacco, but not have so many grades of tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And you could put a long leaf and a medium leaf together. Instead of making two grades, you could make one.
I see.
And it was the same tobacco.
Yeah. So that's when the switch started being
oh,
made.
Yeah.
And
then,
go down a little bit.
Later, of course, while it came along to where you had tobacco shipped around the country on pallets,
mm-hmm.
and now it's shipped in bales, like a bale of hay.
Mm-hmm. The
and the bales make sense because you can handle them much easier, stack them up, ship them.
Mm-hmm. Who were the major buyers at that time that you were dealing with?
The same as they are now,
mm-hmm.
Reynolds Tobacco Company, American, Liggett, Southwestern. Southwestern was strictly a big dealer.
Uh-huh.
And along came Parker Tobacco Company,
mm-hmm.
developed by Alec Parker, Sr.
Mm-hmm.
And then the pool came along. I believe it came along in 1938, if I remember correctly.
Were the warehousemen glad to see that come along?
Oh,
the support
yeah.
support price, uh-huh.
The tobacco industry needed help, and the pool, excuse me, you know, the guarantee of so many dollars for so many pounds.
Mm-hmm. What, you built your warehouse then in 1932. Were there other warehouses being built in that same time period?
Oh, yeah.
Is that when the boom was?
Soon after that, the Burley warehouse was built.
Mm-hmm.
And about that time, Kirk Besson, number one, the brick house was built.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two other warehouses, which now belong to the Browning Manufacturing Company, or Emerson Electric. It was Farmers and Planters. But there now, well, for the old Farmers, mm-hmm. is back in business again.
I see. You were in a very competitive business then at the time.
Still in it.
Yeah. how were those early years then? You'd borrowed money, and this was in the middle of the Depression. How did it go for you?
My dad had some money and pretty fair credit. My aunt had some money, and between those two and Charlie Clark's dad, why, we got started. It didn't take much money to start at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's when the country was living on credit. and you might say short rations.
Short rations. What kind of relationship, as a warehouseman, you have to deal with the buyers, and you have to deal with companies, you have to deal with the farmers. Did your warehouse, I know warehouses attract different crops from different areas of the region. Did you attract a certain kind of farmer? Or?
We hired an auctioneer by the name of O.G. Rucker.
Mm-hmm.
He was the man that put the old Lucky Strike program on the air on radio.
I see.
Was no television then, it was strictly radio. And he was on that a number of years and worked for us for 8 years. Every farmer in the country and every buyer was crazy about O.G. Rucker.
Mm-hmm.
He was the tops of the business. Mm-hmm. And he would come in sometime a month early and solicit tobacco with Charlie Clark or some of the people that worked for us.
Now at that time, were the auctioneers hired by SEP? Were they hired together like they are now?
Auctioneers were hired by each house.
I see.
They had
so
their own house.
This was your auctioneer then?
The Standard and the Home hired O.G. Rucker and had him for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And when he retired, left Maysville, he went back to his hometown in Kinston, and then went to Georgia to work on a market and died in Georgia. Had a heart attack and died on the floor.
And you were mentioning that he would go out with some of your people there,
Mr.
Clark, and solicit. So you thought that was a big plus?
It was a big plus, because every farmer in the country was crazy about O.G. Rucker.
Really? Uh-huh.
He had a wonderful reputation.
And I, of course, you try to provide service at warehouses too. That's another way that, how has that changed, or has that changed much over the years, the way that warehouses deal with farmers? And
not too much. No, I don't think so. We still solicit tobacco, and we try to be nice to everybody that comes in the front door, and we try to take a personal interest in what they do and mm-hmm. send them home with as large a check as possible to get them.
Those early years between the advent of your warehouse and before the program got started, those weren't any of those years that were so low that farmers held it over, or there wasn't too much, was there too much agitation, of course?
Not too much, no. The pool took care of a lot of the problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When I say the pool, I mean the Burley Association. But, what was nicknamed or called the pool.
Let's move to another area of your background, and that was the radio station. What kind of relationship have you had with the radio station over the years? And tell me about your early.
Charlie Clark and I had the application all drawn up to try to put a radio station in Maysville.
Mm-hmm.
In 1940 or 41, and of course the war came along, and that killed any application that was going in for a radio station until after the war. And in 1940, latter part of 46, after the war, and I came home again from the Army, we applied. Took about a year to get it. I'll never forget what happened. I'd go to Washington about every 2 weeks and try to twist a good many arms to get it approved.
Mm-hmm.
And Senator Barkley was our good friend, and he helped us. So we made a good, they were made a good many promises by the chairman of the FCC, and none of them were kept. So one day I went in the senator's office, and he was then vice president.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "You didn't get that application last week approved?" I said, "No, sir. Wasn't even mentioned on the agenda." "You wait here." I remember just as well, he had a big black car that chauffeured him around Washington. Government car. He went out to get in it, and the car wasn't there. He got a taxi and went down to the FCC. In about a half hour, he came back in that taxi. When he came to his office, I was sitting there talking to his administrative assistant. "You'll get your application this Friday." We got it. It was approved on Friday.
was that another example of going straight to the top instead of worrying?
Sure was. I used to know a lot of the tops in Washington and thoroughly enjoying them all.
Yeah. Now, This was a pretty innovative move. There wasn't any radio station in the area. What prompted you to decide to go with a radio station?
Because we thought at that time, and still think it today, that Maysville was a center market located between Cincinnati, Columbus. At that time, Portsmouth was more prosperous than it is today,
mm-hmm.
and Lexington. And we were sitting here all with a market all by ourselves if we could develop it.
If you developed it.
And I'd say the public started with us in 1948, I believe it was. In fact, it was the first minute of 1948, New Year's Eve.
Okay.
And the first person to be on that radio, Ms. Ellen Walton, Ms. John Michael Walton. I remember it real well. She sang Ave Maria. She was number one. And we had a gentleman by the name of Scott True as our farm program director.
Mm-hmm.
Scott lived in Dover, and his home, he called it Eden by the River, and he loved it. He went up, I'll tell you a story about Scott.
Go ahead.
He went up to Washington, went up to New York to a national convention as their guest, radio convention. And of course, he took Ms. True with him. And they were sitting in the auditorium in the, I forget which hotel it was, Scott was back in the stage, watching through the curtain. And a lady was sitting in front of Ms. True. And when Scott told me this himself. He said, I was watching through that hole in that curtain, and the closer it came to my time to go out and get behind the microphone and give him my talk, my knees were hitting together. Said I was scared to death. And said when I was introduced and walked out on that big stage, about 2,000 people in the audience, that I forgot everything that I was supposed to say. And so when I got to the microphone, I started telling stories and jokes and said, finally my speech came to me, but said I still mix it with a lot of jokes and stories. And Scott was unnatural at that business. People loved him for that reason. And the lady sitting in front of me, it's true, got up and went out and came back and brought a big, heavy-set fellow with her. They sat there and listened, and she leaned over and said, General, you've never heard anybody like this man. He should be on NBC. And it turned out to be General Sarnoff, president of RCA, and president of Radio Corporation of America. So they got Scott backstage and offered him made him an offer to go on NBC on a farm program coast to coast. Scott said, General, you don't know how much I appreciate this. But said, I live in a little town, Dover, down on the Ohio River in Kentucky, between Maysville and Cincinnati, and said, my farm is named Eden by the River. And I'll always love what you offered me, and I'll always have a lot of respect for you. But I'm going back to live and die in Eden by the River.
You didn't want to leave Eden again. that program, I guess, started almost from the beginning.
It was. And it was on the first day, and it's still on today.
It's still on today.
That's right.
The radio station has always, through, I guess, your guidance, has always been interested in agriculture.
Oh, yeah.
In the area.
Yeah, this is an agriculture community, and we cater to the farmer and try to give him the best we know how.
Mm-hmm.
We have a gentleman by the name of Bill Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
Bill does a good job.
Yeah. That was one of your original intents then, I guess, the radio station.
Sure was.
And you located that there on the square where you have...
That's right. We started where we are now.
Uh-huh. Right there with the tobacco warehouse.
We have... That was an AM station then. We still have it. Now we have it at an FM station.
Mm-hmm.
3,000-watt FM.
Yeah. The call letters, did you choose those?
I'll tell you a story about that.
Uh-huh.
In our application, I put in the request for a WFTM. Which would stand for the world's finest tobacco market.
Mm-hmm.
We were turned down because they had been assigned to a little police station up in upper New York State. I think it was Hudson, New York.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after we were turned down and found out about it, I called the chief of police up there, told him who it was, what I wanted, where we were, and why I wanted WFTM was it would stand for our tobacco market. He said, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, if you'll send me an old country ham and a twist of chewing tobacco, I'll ask the FCC to assign our call letters to you and give us some more. Excuse me, and that's the way we got them.
You were able to.
That's the way we got them.
The radio station's been not only a benefit to farmers, giving them information and promoting local tobacco market, but also as a resource, community resource. Let's talk about that just a little bit. And I know this is a little bit off farming, but your role as a community leader, you've always been interested in promoting this region. First, let me ask you, where do you see agriculture fitting into that promotion? How important is agriculture to our area?
Well, not too long ago, I guess it was a year ago now, maybe a year and a half, I was at a bank meeting down in Cincinnati, and each bank president was asked to stand up and say something about his hometown, his home business, and his bank.
Mm-hmm.
And when my time came around, I got up and told who I was, where I was from, Maysville, Kentucky, and president of the Bank of Maysville, the oldest bank in Kentucky. And I said, I think I'm probably the luckiest man in this room, and I'll tell you why. Said, in about 2 miles of my desk, up the Ohio River, As far as I know, we have the largest electric power plant in the United States. I think it cost around $1 billion. And 2 miles down the river from my desk, we have another plant, electric plant, that was about half that size. And regardless of the economy, those two electric plants are going to operate and serve the public. And there'll always be big payrolls, good salaries, and good jobs at those two plants. I said, in addition to that, we just finished a tobacco market that put, I believe it was about $80 million in our community, in the farmers' pockets. And I said, you can't find many small towns with two big industrial payrolls like those power plants and an $80 million farmer economy for one product, plus in the summertime, many more incomes from hogs, cattle, sheep, and whatever we have. Mm-hmm. And I said, I think I live in a charmed spot of the world right now.
So agriculture is central to us.
Oh, yeah.
And always.
Yes, sir.
Have you seen that in your years of experience? Is that role declining? Your businesses are, you have multiple businesses in the course. I'm sure the warehouse is an important part of your business, as is the radio station, and you work here at the bank. Have you seen one ebb and flow at the expense of the other? Or?
Mr. Clee, I think that's a good question to tell you why, because I think we have to make up our mind, all of us do, that we're living in a world market. Mm-hmm. Not just a little local market, but a world market. If you think I'm wrong, look, since Japan started shipping cars into this country and now building them here, that's brought the price down of other cars. Since they started shipping crude oil into this country from through the Gulf and Persian Gulf and back in that part of the world into Kentucky and through the all over the United States to refineries, think how it's brought the price of gasoline down. We're in a world market. And we might as well make up our mind to adjust to it and live with it. Mm-hmm. I think the farmer has to make up his mind to make a lot of changes, because the high price of tobacco in the last few years, 10 years, 12 years, has crowded a lot of other products out of the farm, off of the farm. Mm-hmm. I'll go back to Maize Lick. We were talking about Maize Lick a few minutes ago. Many years ago, that was world famous, or nationally famous, for raising the finest asparagus in the country. There was a big hemp market out there. Mm-hmm. You use hemp to make ropes. I think the farmer has to begin to diversify and realize that tobacco is fine. It'll always bring him good money. It'll always be used for it, regardless of what the Surgeon General says. But I think that tobacco has crowded too many other good products out of the neighborhoods that could support them. Mm-hmm. And I'm going back to asparagus. Mm-hmm. Maize Lick, I think, community has the finest ground in the world to raise asparagus. And the asparagus is an expensive crop.
Sure is.
It's a garden crop, but it's an expensive crop. Mm-hmm. And to back up that statement, I think history shows that soil from Maize Lick was displayed at the World's Fair in London back in the 1800s as the richest soil in the United States. I think a farmer can do a lot of things to help himself, and he has to make up his mind to make a few changes. Yeah.
So what you're saying is that in your day, you've seen tobacco become more and more important to the farmer at the expense of some of these other things.
That's right. That's a good way to look at it, too, at the expense of other good things.
Yeah. But you think agriculture is going to remain important to our area? You don't think it's going to be completely replaced by industry or
business? No. This will never be an industrial community. I think that we have overlooked the value of the transportation on the Ohio River.
Yes, sir.
I think that it could be used for heavy industry. Mm-hmm. And I think it will be used for heavy industry. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why it's been overlooked all these years. I believe we're beginning to realize that. The Ohio River is a real asset. And now you can ship from, I believe it's Memphis, to Mobile and save somewhere around 280 miles in that for freight in that the trip. And there's a huge port in Biloxi and two or three good ports down there.
Let me, while we're on this.
Wait just a minute, and excuse me, the coal, a lot of the coal that comes out of Kentucky, I don't think the public knows it, but it goes down this river, and you'd be surprised how much of it winds up in Japan. It goes, a lot of that coal goes to New Orleans, transferred into ocean-going barges, and winds up at the factories in Japan. And that's the way it should be, too.
Yeah. It's another market for one of our products.
Why, certainly.
While we're on this idea about the business and industry in the area, I know about some of your leadership role in, for example, the Chamber of Commerce bringing a full-time director. That's been in my experience here. Could you relate some of those things that have happened over the years and in promoting this area?
Well, I remember one real well. I was president of the chamber here for 3 years, and the DuPont Company owned 2,000 acres of land down the river, almost a stone's throw from the far end of town, and they were going to build a plant there to make Corflam. Well, that's a simulated leather.
Yes, sir.
They built one in California, and you might say that it laid an egg. So that killed the idea of building the plant here.
I see.
And that good river land, land exposed to the river and the railroad too, laid there for a number of years. Well, I went to Wilmington a number of times and tried to get that land for the Chamber of Commerce here at Maysville. Mm-hmm. And finally wound up eating dinner with the president of DuPont twice. And maybe through that friendship, I got the land for Maysville, Kentucky, option at $1,500 an acre. Came home and it was written up all over Kentucky. Well, East Kentucky Power either heard about it or read it and came down to see if they could get it. Well, I got the DuPont people down here, the head of the real estate division and one of their vice presidents, and they had no trouble trading with East Kentucky to take it all. And that's the way that plant happens to be, 2 miles from this desk down the river.
Yes, sir.
And that was the nicest experience I had with the chamber. I had a lot of good ones, but that was a big one, of course.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, the bank's still very active in the chamber. And I recall when the leadership role when the executive director was coming here.
Well, I'm not a director any longer. Yeah. I was for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was a director of the Boys Club for 20 years.
I saw that.
I was a director of the Chamber of Commerce for 20 years. I was a director of the Small Business Administration for 20 years. And I decided it was time to quit taking care of the other fellow's business and take care of my own. So I resigned from all of them.
This is side two of a tape with Mr. Finch of the Bank of Maysville. I wanted to talk about, you talked about how the family was in banking. How did your experience with banking here start?
Well, my dad was president of the bank, and after I got pretty active in tobacco business and other things around here, he thought he and Mr. Jim Kehoe, who was president of the bank before that, decided I should be a director, and I was elected to take someone's place. I forget who now.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, when my dad died, they elected me president of the bank in 1958, and I guess I've pretty well fooled them ever since. Been here ever since 1958. That seemed like a long, long time ago.
Now, you've mentioned it once, but I know, you know, it's a mark of pride for the community and the bank that this is the first bank in Kentucky.
That's right.
and
the Secretary of State called me yesterday and said, I'm going to write you a letter that makes it official that the Bank of Maysville is the oldest bank in the state of Kentucky.
Is that right?
Started in 1835.
Mm-hmm.
And said, you can quote me as Secretary of State of Kentucky.
State of Kentucky. Tell me about your relationship with farmers. You've been the head of this bank. Have farmers been an important part of this business?
And farmers are an important part of any business in the agriculture part of Kentucky, certainly. We like them, we cater to them, we do the best we know how. We've got a lot of, I don't know whether you saw them in the front window, a lot of small animals.
Mm-hmm.
And we finance those, try to finance livestock farming for the farmer. And I don't mind telling you, we believe in the hog business. If one sow can have, we'll say, 14 pigs a year or 20 pigs a year, look at the odds, 14 to 1 or 20 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
You can't find that in any other
kind of business
product on a farm that I know of. Mm-hmm. And we certainly believe in hogs.
Mm-hmm.
And all kinds of livestock, but
sure,
particularly hogs.
Yeah.
Brood
and
sows.
And have supported that
sure
pretty strongly. Of course, this section of the bank that we're in, your farm officer, you know, you've had a farm. Bert Collins, of course,
oh, yeah,
was a farm officer for a long time.
And we missed Bert Collins,
yeah,
too.
I was crazy about it. I was able to interview him many years ago. Farmers, obviously, I guess, are having a very difficult time today. Have you seen those kinds of problems before? Is this nothing new, or
farmers,
do you see it as unique?
Or? Oh, yeah, back in 1932, my golly, you couldn't hardly give an acre of land away if you had to pay taxes on it.
Mm-hmm.
But President Roosevelt came out with the best thing that I think's ever happened to the farmer. Back in 1930, he started what they call, I believe in 1931, he started what they call the CCC.
Mm-hmm.
And the government, if the farmer couldn't afford it, the government paid for terracing land, ditching land, financing, fertilizing land.
Mm-hmm.
And put a lot of farmers, instead of putting them off the land or kicking them out of their farm, put them back into business and helped them financially and I'd say physically, hold on to what they had, and finally they began to pay their bills. And they've done pretty well right up to now.
Mm-hmm.
Our farmers are not in good shape, and they're not in bad shape. I'd say they're medium, and they're lucky.
Yeah.
If they lived out in the West, the corn and the wheat section, they would really hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But we have enough diversification here to have some pretty solid farmers.
From what you've said earlier, that sounds like something that obviously you've recommended too, is to maintain diversification. And,
oh yeah. Yeah, there were two lawyers here yesterday from New York, and they couldn't imagine the few farm or the good farm loans that we have. Well, they said, we thought everybody was going to the government to be financed. No, we take care of our own farmers the best we know how.
Yes, sir.
And we have plenty of good farm customers.
Mm-hmm. I know that this has been something, I know that you've done some lobbying on behalf of tobacco. Talked to people, congressmen, sent letters to people. Could you discuss that with me? That's something that I think has been relatively late, because before, I guess, you didn't have to defend tobacco.
I'm going to cut that a little short because my dad did some of that. I haven't done too much on the tobacco business.
Mm-hmm.
I have on other things.
Mm-hmm.
But my son, Jim Finch, is chairman of the board of the Burley Auction Warehouse Association.
Yes, sir.
He was president for 3 years, and now he's been chairman for two.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes to all their meetings, and he does a lot of lobbying. He's been to Washington. He'll be there again pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
But he knows more about that as of today than I do.
Yes, sir. Yeah, well, I had talked to him, too, and had about his role in that, how that's been important. Let me get off the tobacco subject for a little while. I'd like just to talk to you about this community and some of the changes you've seen over the years, some of the people you've known. If you had to characterize it, what are some of the most significant changes you've seen? Of course, the community's kind of got two different areas now. We've got what some people call the top of the hill, and others call the, I guess, the business district or whatever.
Well, some people are interested in the old part of town, downtown. The other people are interested in the top of the hill, and I don't mind telling you, Mr. Key, I've got a chip on my shoulder on that subject. I think there should be one Maysville, Kentucky, and everybody else shut up on on the two subjects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You saw that growth taking place over the years.
The best thing that's happened to us for growth is this AA highway. Mm-hmm. It'll go from Ashland, which hooks into the interstate highways up there, mm-hmm. two of them, one east and west, one north and south. And it'll hook into the interstate highways at Alexandria, and that'll take you on out to the Cincinnati airport, or you can turn north and go into Cincinnati, or go on north any place you want to go.
Whatever.
Sure.
Yeah.
So that really, AA highway will put us on the good road for the first time.
Yeah.
And I don't mind telling you, if John Y. Brown is governor, I'm doing my best to get him to improve the road from Blue Licks all the way to Paris. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get in that fight at Paris between Paris and Lexington.
Lexington, right.
If he'll take it from Blue Licks to Paris, why, I think the rest of it will take care of itself
yes.
in time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that'll put us on another section of interstate roads.
Yeah.
Good ones.
That, of course, when you listen to WFTM today, you still hear that comment about the center market.
That's right.
That would really bring it to fruit in a way.
I think so. We hope so.
What about some of the individuals you've known, and you've talked about the Vice President Barkley? Have there been other people of note that you think really have that this area is particularly indebted to, or people that you've had good working relations with?
Well, yes. I was fortunate enough to be on the train coming through Kentucky with President Harry Truman when he was running for the second. Let's say he filled out one term,
right,
and then he went in the second time for on his own.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky enough to be on the train with President Truman and his wife, Bess Truman, and daughter, and half a dozen other people. Certainly had a fine time, and I got crazy about him.
Mm-hmm.
And I should have had sense enough to know that he was going to win.
Nobody else believed that.
Nobody else believed it, but he would go out on the observation car. He'd stop in the town and go out on the observation car, and he'd make about half of his talk, almost the same thing every place, but that was all right.
Yeah.
He got about half through, and all he wants to say is, Lucy Jones here. Well, he knew Lucy was there because he had had men in advance locating people like that.
Yeah.
And Lucy would holler, "Here I am, Harry. Lucy, hi is my cousin Lucy." And he... The whole crowd would love it.
Oh, yeah.
But he was a wonderful president, too.
What about
a lot of common sense.
Yeah. What about some of our governors? Of course, some people mention Combs as being someone that, from having local roots here or had some connections here, that he was good for the area. Was there any of those individuals that...
We've never had a governor come from this town that I know of.
No,
not in my lifetime, anyway. But I admire the ability of a number of them, and one of them is Happy Chandler.
Yes, sir.
Happy and I are still good friends. I hear from him pretty often. And one thing I liked about him, he ran a good common sense. See, he was governor twice.
Yes, sir.
The first time he was fair, but the second time he was a fine governor. When he left office, he had done a good job. But instead of leaving a lot of debts for the other fellow, he left a balance, he left money in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the whole state still respects him for that, everybody that knew him.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a funny thing about him. I knew him in Washington pretty well. And he had a national reputation up there for many things, but one of them, the outstanding thing, was he lived in the Mayflower Hotel. And people would come, "Happy, how are you? Glad to see you. Oh, Harry, I'm glad to see you too. Come on, eat dinner with me tonight. Bring your wife." And he'd run into somebody else and invite them too. "Meet you down in the dining room at 7:30. I'll have a table reserved. All right. You get there, and he had maybe a half a dozen or a dozen guests.
Mm-hmm.
They'd all order deluxe dinners. Happy would entertain the crowd, have a grand time with them. When the ticket came around, the check came around to sign it or pay it, Happy had a reputation of having the second fastest hand in Washington reaching for a dinner ticket. Not the first, but he had the second fastest.
You're fairly optimistic about, as you said, you know, your son's been more active in the politics of the Baca, but as far as the community and how everything pulls together, you're pretty optimistic about where we're going here and how
I'm optimistic about where we're going if this big, huge $2 trillion debt we have in Washington doesn't choke us to death and mm-hmm. cause another 1929. I'm a great person to believe in cycles. And I know sometime that's got to catch up with us.
I see.
The answer is when.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's going to, maybe it won't hit in the next year or two, but it could hit any time.
Since you brought that back, brought that topic back up, that event obviously altered your life the first time and maybe
sure did.
Brought you back here to Kentucky sooner than you might have or maybe sure. maybe not at all. you have no regrets about coming back here to your home and
building
the businesses.
I came back because I wanted to. I still had a job in Washington, the brokerage house, if I wanted to stay.
I see.
Or in the east, I don't mean Washington.
Yeah.
And I came back, I love home, I enjoy it here, and the old saying is, I'm gonna stay around here as long as I got my boots on. And keep busy if I can. Enjoy every day. Enjoy my friends. Enjoy my family.
Uh-huh. I appreciate you talking to me.